is Hitler's War by David Irving. The chapter is Blue. In mid-1942, Hitler launched his rebuilt armies into Operation Blue, the summer campaign that he hoped would leave him master of all Europe as far as Astrakhan, Stalingrad, and Baku. That whole thing rhymed. It's great. Yet great though the advances the Wehrmacht now made were, strategically, the Soviet command remained the victor. After Kharkov, which Hitler considered one of Stalin's most costly errors, the Red Army was never again to allow the Germans to encircle them. Each successive phase of Blue netted a smaller haul of prisoners and booty than the last. When the Red Army did stand and fight, it was on its own terms, with winter drawing on and at the extreme limit of the German supply lines, or lines of supply, as Irving writes. Emboldened by the victory at Kharkov, Hitler switched his attention to the two Russian armies orphaned by the disaster. He decided on a short postponement of Blue, while two preliminary battles, Fridericus II and Wilhelm, respectively, were fought to wipe out these enemy concentrations. He flew to Field Marshal von Bock's headquarters at Poltava on June 1st and won his general's support, explaining that this was an opportunity they would be foolish to miss. Quote, "What we defeat now can't interfere with our later Blue offensive," he said. End quote. Wilhelm began 9 days afterward, followed by Fridericus II on the 22nd. Meanwhile, General von Manstein had begun the long-drawn-out final bombardment and assault on the Crimean fortress of Sebastopol. Blue itself, originally scheduled for mid-June, was provisionally set down for the 22nd. On June 4, 1942, Hitler made one of his very rare flights outside the Reich frontiers to honor Finland's Marshal Mannerheim on his 75th birthday. In the dining car of Mannerheim's special train, its broad windows overlooking the sunlit Lake Saima, Hitler was tempted by the polished speech of President Ritty to rise and reply himself. While the local German envoy looked on disapprovingly and the marshal, perhaps unaware of his visitor's aversion to tobacco, affably puffed clouds of cigar smoke, he delivered ex tempore a tactful speech on his awkward position during Finland's winter war with Russia. After the Führer's four-engined Focke-Wulf 200 took off, a flattered Mannerheim commented, quote-unquote, "He is phenomenal!" Flying back from Finland, Hitler heard that Reinhard Heydrich had died of his wounds. After that, his attention was again attracted to the Jews by reports that German political émigrés were fighting in the ranks of the French Foreign Legion against Rommel in North Africa. On June 9th, he had a signal radioed to Rommel's headquarters ordering that such émigrés were to be mercilessly finished off in battle. Any who were taken prisoner were to be shot at once and without further ado on the orders of the nearest German officer, quote-unquote. That was the day of the state funeral of Heydrich, held in the Chancellery. Czech President Emil Hácha and his government attended. 600 of Germany's leading men gathered behind Hitler to pay homage to the Gestapo chief. Hitler used to call him, quote, "the man with the iron nerves," unquote. According to his historical officer, Wilhelm Scheidt, Hitler had been grooming him to become his successor. In Prague, Heydrich had modeled himself on Hitler, winning the workers over. By the time of his assassination, the first 20 convalescent homes had already been built for Czech workers. On the day he died, 50,000 such workers demonstrated in Prague in a remarkable manifestation against the British-inspired act. As Siegfried's funeral march died away, Himmler spoke, recalling the day Heydrich had taken up the reins in Bohemia and Moravia. Quote, "There were many in Germany, and many more among the Czechs, who thought the dreaded Heydrich was going to rule by blood and terror." End quote. But he had not. Himmler explained. He had merely acted radically against the quote-unquote unruly dissidents, restoring respect for German rule and beginning his internal social reforms soon after. Before President Hácha left Berlin, Hitler advised him to keep the Czechs in rein. If there was any repetition of the anti-German outbreaks that had caused him to appoint Heydrich in September, he said he would seriously consider deporting all the Czechs from Bohemia and Moravia. Hacha asked permission to warn his people. Hitler recommended that he do so. At 11:10 p.m., he left for Bavaria. There, on June 15th, Admiral Raeder drove up to the Berghof to press the case for the attack on Malta. In May, Parachute General Kurt Student had briefed Hitler on the British fortifications and defenses, but to Hitler it seemed that more was known of the probable British tactics than the Italian. Jodl's naval staff officer had told the Admiralty, quote, "The Führer has little confidence in the operation's success, as the Italians' assault strength is wholly inadequate, and the Italians don't have the least idea of secrecy. It seems to be a particularly difficult task, far tougher than Crete, which was difficult enough as it was," end quote. Hitler offered a string of specious arguments against invading Malta. Even if they succeeded, the Italians could not keep the island garrison supplied, to which the Admiralty acidly pointed out that at present the far more difficult supply line to Rommel's army in North Africa was still open. Even more far-fetched was Hitler's claim that Malta served their strategy better in British hands, as its supply convoys then offered sitting targets in the anti-shipping war. Hitler had allowed the, quote, "theoretical planning," unquote, for Malta to continue during May, but now, on June 15th, he offered the admiral little hope that the assault would ever take place. Over 200 submarines were now in or entering German service, a fruit of the prudent policy of conversation that Hitler had enforced in 1940. Hitler regretted not having devoted more shipyard capacity to submarine construction rather than to big warships. The latter did, however, have a deterrent value. For this reason, he had at first been averse to the Admiralty's plan for the Knight's Move, quote-unquote Knight's Move, in which the entire German battle fleet in Norway was to attempt to wipe out the next Allied convoy bearing supplies to North Russia, PQ-17, Raeder's PQ-17. Raeder's liaison officer had assured Hitler early in June that no risk would be involved at all, provided that the Reichsmarschall was ordered to give them Luftwaffe support. When the admiral left the Berghof on June 15th, he had Hitler's cautious permission to proceed, provided that any Allied aircraft carriers in the vicinity had first been precisely located and bombed to a standstill. On the Russian front, the enemy was tensely waiting Hitler's next move. It seemed clear that the Russians were no longer deceived by Kluge's noisy preparations west of Moscow. Indeed, on June 16th, an Allied press agency in Moscow quoted German strategic designs for the summer at such length that it was obvious that there was a leak in German security somewhere. Hitler was perplexed and furious. Halder's general staff must be the culprit, he suspected. Hitler was infuriated to learn that the senior general staff officer of a panzer division had crash-landed in no man's land with the complete secret plans for the first stage of Blue, the tank thrust into the Don at Voronezh, just as had happened in the notorious Mechelen affair in 1940. He himself signed a new order expanding the security rules he had laid down then. Quote, "Security during the preparation of major operations is of particular importance because of the prime risk that operational orders falling into enemy hands might be exploited in time." End quote. As it was, he coolly ordered the strategic plan for Blue to be left unchanged. Toward midnight on June 21st, his train left Munich for Berlin. His thoughts must have gone back to that night 12 months earlier when he had spent agonizing hours waiting for the onset of Barbarossa. If it had not been for his stubborn army generals last summer, Russia would have long been defeated. During the night, his train pulled into a station for 20 minutes. The telephones were linked up, and there was joyous and totally unexpected news from North Africa. The British stronghold of Tobruk had fallen. Already General Rommel was preparing to sweep eastward into Egypt. Hitler cabled him immediately, promoting him to field marshal. When Goebbels, now referred over lunch to Rommel's irrepressible popularity, Hitler enthusiastically agreed. He told his staff that he would telephone Mussolini, advising him to give Rommel a free hand. The message he telegraphed to Rome closed with his familiar argument, quote, "The battle's goddess of fortune draws nigh upon the commanders only once. He who does not grasp her at that moment will seldom come to grips with her again," end quote. Mussolini allowed himself to be persuaded. Hercules was postponed until early September. Within a week, Rommel hoped to be in Cairo. The Italian command and Field Marshal Kesselring, Hitler's commander-in-chief south, watched the Panzer Army's eastward progress into Egypt with mounting apprehension. Hitler remained optimistic. Although Rommel had received barely 3,000 tons of supplies for the entire army during June, Hitler saw Egypt already in his hands. Quote, "Rommel must be given all the supplies he needs," end quote, he announced at supper on June 28th after the news arrived that four enemy divisions were now encircled in the fortress of Marsa Matru. He agreed with Keitel's prediction that, quote, "when the Germans captured Alexandria, the entire British public would be thrown into a far greater rage than at the surrender of Singapore. Let's hope that the American legation in Cairo continues to keep us so excellently informed of the British military plans with its badly enciphered cables," he said. After Blue was over in the autumn, an Anglo-German settlement seemed certain. The British army, however, was preparing to hold out some 60 miles west of Alexandria, at El Alamein, and Field Marshal Rommel now had only 70 tanks and armored cars at his disposal. Operation Blue had begun early on June 28, 1942. German and Hungarian divisions commanded by General Maximilian von Weichs swept eastward toward the Don city of Voronezh. 2 days later, General Paulus's 6th Army began an advance that was eventually to take it southward along the Don. Hitler, encouraged by the evidence presented to him by Halder, believed the Russian reserves were all but exhausted. He began thinking of taking two armored divisions from Blue for a later assault on Moscow. Hitler anticipated an elastic strategy from Marshal Timoshenko, his Russian adversary in the south, but he hoped to thwart this by moving his tanks down the Don fast enough to prevent the enemy's withdrawal beyond it. Remembering Dunkirk in 1940 and Leningrad in 1941, Hitler feared that Voronezh in particular would swallow up his precious armor for days on end. Keitel recognized the familiar omens of trouble and begged him to fly out in person and order Bach to leave the city alone. Hitler made the 3-hour flight to Poltava, arriving at 7 a.m. on July 3rd, confronted by the granite-faced field marshal. However, he lost his tongue. Far from flatly forbidding Bach to take the city of Voronezh, Hitler wrapped up his directives in a double negative so vague that he was leaving Bach queried, quote, "Am I right in understanding you as follows? I am to capture Voronezh, if it can be done easily or without bloodshed, but I am not to get involved in heavy fighting for the city," end quote. Hitler confirmed this with a silent nod. Back at the Wolf's Lair, his courage returned to him. He watched the developing battle impatiently. The city was captured easily enough on July 6th, but the two armored divisions there were immediately subject to a fierce Russian counterattack. As the unwanted battle for the city developed, precious time was wasted. Not until the 8th could the divisions disengage themselves from Voronezh, and after 1 day's southward progress, their fuel ran out. Boiling with anger, Hitler could see the Russian forces slipping away. Bach was having a run of bad luck. Hitler sacked him. He told Schmundt he still admired the man, but in the present crisis, he could work only with generals who followed his directives to the letter. The consequences were serious. When the first phase of Blue ended on July 8th, Weichs had rounded up only 28,000 prisoners and 1,000 tanks, and the 6th Army had accounted for only 45,000 prisoners and 200 tanks. A week later, the second phase, an attempted encirclement of the enemy north of the Donets River, ended with the capture of Milarovo. This time there were only 14,000 prisoners. In retrospect, it should have been clear that the majority of the Red Army had escaped. Hitler, ill-advised by his general staff, evidently considered these low hauls further proof that the Red Army was on its last legs. Meanwhile, on June 21st, the 3rd Air Force had brought back photographic reconnaissance of southern England revealing nearly 3,000 small craft assembled between Portsmouth and Portland, the numbers of unfamiliar craft drawn ashore at Southampton and Poole. Churchill was brewing something. Halder suggested sending an armored division to the west. Hitler agreed and ordered that three others already in reserve there should remain. Together with the SS division Das Reich and the 7th Air Division of paratroops. On June 26th, he decided that, quote, if the Russian resistance during the coming operations should be less than expected, end quote, the two SS divisions, Adolf Hitler lifeguards and Death's Heads, would also be transferred to the west. He predicted in a directive of July 9th that the Allies would most probably invade either somewhere between Dieppe and Le Havre or in Normandy, as these coastal areas were within Allied fighter range and suitable for small craft crossings. He believed that Churchill's recent visit to Washington had only one purpose, to advise against launching a full-scale second front invasion until 1943. He may have deduced this from intercepted radio telephone traffic between London and Washington. Hitler certainly mentioned Churchill himself as proof, but he accepted that Churchill was now desperate to help the Russians. In the Arctic, German submarines and bombers sank 24 of the 36 Allied merchant ships bound for North Russia in convoy PQ-17. Tirpitz and the battle fleet did not even have to go into action. At the daily war conferences, Hitler's advisers were confident of victory in Russia. In his eyes, the East was already a German empire. On July 29th, he discussed with Himmler the final plans for settling the South Tyroleans in the Crimea. On the 16th, he told Himmler he had no intention of overtly annexing Transcaucasia to the German Empire. It would suffice to put a guard on the oil fields and frontiers and leave a resident general to protect German interests in the Free Caucasian Protectorates, as they would be known. On the 23rd, he instructed Bormann to issue to Reichsleiter Rosenberg broad guidelines for population control in the East. German standards of sanitation and public health would not be enforced. When Hitler learned that his troops had fathered over 1 million offspring with Russian women, he instructed Himmler to identify all the children concerned, select those that were racially promising, and recover them for Germany. If the mothers were also sound and racially acceptable, they could come too. Still uneasy at the prospect that in later generations, even the rejected offspring might improve the Russian bloodstock, Hitler ordered the widest distribution of contraceptives to his troops in the East forthwith. As for education, Hitler told his police officials, quote, I can only repeat what the Führer has asked. It is enough if, firstly, the children are taught the traffic signs at school so that they won't run under our cars. Secondly, they learn to count to 25. And thirdly, they can write their names as well. No more is necessary. For the final heave on the Eastern Front, Hitler transferred to a forward headquarters in the Ukraine codenamed Werewolf. I don't need to put an accent on that. At Vinnytsia. At 8:15 a.m. on July 16th, 1942, his entire staff flew in 16 planes to the new site. 3 hours later, they touched down at Vinnytsia. In these headquarters, Hitler's commandant feared only a paratroop attack, perhaps disguised in German uniforms, so the Führer found none of the concrete bunkers characterizing the Wolf's lair at Rostenburg. But the cabins were damp, the climate was humid, and each evening, everybody had to swallow atabrine, a bitter anti-malaria concoction against which the tongue rebelled. Hitler detested the camp. At night, it was icy cold. By day, Vinnytsia sweltered in the Ukrainian high summer. He suffered splitting headaches and easily found fault with everybody. OKW diarist Helmut Greiner noted privately, quote, the climate and heat here get the Führer down. He longs for his old bunker at Rostenburg, which is a sure sign of where we'll be quartered this winter. By then, our operations in the Caucasus will be virtually completed anyway. End quote. With that, Hitler hoped his oil nightmare would be banished. Once he said, quote, if I cannot capture at least Maykop, I cannot fight on. End quote. If he could get the oil fields at both Maykop and Grozny producing 5 million tons a year, and even more if his armies captured the Baku oil fields south of the Caucasus, then Stalin would have to concede defeat. In front of Paulus's 6th Army, the enemy was in full flight towards Stalingrad. The Russian command seemed to be losing control. In a string of directives issued late in July, Hitler confidently asserted that the 3-week campaign had thus far attained virtually all the targets he had set for the Southern Front. The operations against Marshal Timoshenko had gone far better and faster, quote-unquote, than expected. Hitler claimed, quote, only puny elements of Timoshenko's armies have managed to escape encirclement and get south of the Don, end quote. Already, he divided Army Group South into two new army groups, A and B. To the former, he had appointed Field Marshal List, and to the latter, General von Weichs. These two groups would now diverge across the Don. List's group to encircle the escaping Russians south of Rostov and then conquer the Caucasus and the Black Sea coast, and Weichs striking southeastward towards Stalingrad and the Volga. As Hitler was convinced that the river was Stalin's main waterway. After Stalingrad, the armored divisions would roll down the Volga to Astrakhan on the Caspian Sea. For the capture of Stalingrad, he had assigned only one of the 4 German armies on hand there, here, the 6th. Rostov was captured after fierce fighting on July 23rd, but the enemy escaped, blowing up the bridges behind him. 2 days later, the entire west bank of the Don was in German hands. Again, however, the German army's supply organization broke down. For days, the 6th Army's tanks were stranded without gasoline. Worse still, on July 25th, Quartermaster General Wagner diverted all logistics effort from Stalingrad to the Caucasus operation. Weichs phoned, pleading for the decision to be reversed. Hitler overruled Wagner, but for 10 days the 6th Army was emasculated by this lack of supplies, while the Russian commanders had time to build a line of defense far to the west of Stalingrad. At Werwolf, violent arguments broke out in the thin-walled wooden conference hut. Haller raged in private that his layman's grotesque ignorance Halder raged in private at this layman's grotesque ignorance. Hitler snarled that Halder had repeatedly ignored his orders to transfer a panzer group from the Rostov group to support the 6th Army. On July 26th, List's army group swept across the Don for the attack on the Caucasus. It was supported by Richthofen's 4th Air Force. Halder wrote the next day, July 30th, quote, at the Führer's conference, General Jodl took the floor and bombastically pronounced that the fate of the Caucasus will be decided at Stalingrad, end quote. This was what Halder had been arguing for a week himself. It was decided to transfer the 4th Panzer Army from List to Weichs at once. In vain, List protested. When Halder phoned him that evening, his group too was suffering fuel delays. And he underlined the gamble they were taking by driving southward into the Caucasus with such a weak force, unprotected on its flank. When he asked that at least the Gross Deutschland division should not be transferred to France, Halder was equally adamant. Thus, 2 German armies, each with less dependable Allied forces in train, were assigned to each of Hitler's southern strategic targets, Stalingrad and the Caucasus. If the enemy's reserves were finished, this was an adequate disposition. If they were not, it was not. From the documents available, it is clear that Hitler did not fear any serious assault on Western Europe until 1943. But there were persistent rumors that something was in the air. An Abwehr agent in embassy circles in Madrid reported that Britain was assembling 2,400 craft for an invasion attempt on the Channel or French Atlantic coast toward the end of August. On July 18th, a week of talks between Churchill and Roosevelt's confidant Harry Hopkins began in London. 2 days later, a batch of intercepted transatlantic telephone conversations was sent to Himmler, and no doubt Hitler, with an SS general's comments, quote, although only code words are employed in these intercepted telephone conversations, I deduced the following. Today and tomorrow, there must be a highly important meeting between the British and Americans. This conference will probably determine where the second front is to be established and when. The main people speaking are general staff officers, ambassadors, and ministers. End quote. On August 13th, a highly trusted Abwehr agent in South England reported that the invasion target would be the Channel port of Dieppe. Hitler had 29 divisions in the West, but the more he studied the bulky military atlases that his experts had compiled, the more apprehensive he became. He sent out Walter Frentz, his staff movie cameraman, to tour the coastline and photograph what he could find. The color photographs revealed that the whole coast would be wide open to a determined Allied assault. He resolved to build an impregnable fortress line along the entire Atlantic coastline facing Britain. On August 13th, he summoned Albert Speer and military experts to his Werwolf headquarters and lectured them on his requirements for this Atlantic wall. It must be such that an armed force of 500,000 troops, the entire coastline could be defended. Cost was no obstacle. Quote, our most costly substance is the German man. The blood these fortifications will spare is worth billions. The wall, quote, our most costly substance is the German man. The blood these fortifications will spare is worth billions, end quote. The wall was to be completed by the end of April 1934. The submarine bases and naval gun sites were to get special treatment. Heavy machine guns, tanks, and anti-tank guns must all come under cover, for Hitler predicted that any invasion would begin with the saturation bombardment of the entire area. Quote, it is wisest to consider our own Luftwaffe so weak in the West as to be non-existent, end quote, Hitler warned. All bunkers must be gas-proof, he ordered, and have oxygen supplies on hand. The Allies might use napalm bombs, so the bunkers must have steps and ledges to check the flow of blazing oil. The enemy must think twice about even testing this wall, and when an invasion did begin, it would have to be in such strength that it would be no problem for Hitler to distinguish the real Schwerpunkt from any diversionary feints. He predicted in August 1942 that the invasion would be preceded during the night by waves of airborne troops with orders to disrupt the transport and signal systems and disable headquarters units. The invasion proper would follow at dawn, with 3,000 or 4,000 landing craft and total enemy air superiority. Of course, as he told a Balkan diplomat on August 14th, those mad British might try something even before 1943. Quote, as lunatics like that drunkard Churchill and Maccabees and numbskulls like that brilliantined dandy Eden are at the helm, we've to be prepared for just about anything, end quote. Quote, we've steeled ourselves for surprises, Rundstedt wrote privately on August 15th, particularly now that Churchill has visited Moscow. Well, let 'em come. What occurred, end quote. What occurred 4 days later was a baffling coup de theater by the British. Two brigades of Canadian troops were landed with 30 tanks and commandos on either side of the Dieppe. The raid ended in debacle. The British lost a destroyer, 33 landing craft, over 100 planes, and 4,000 troops, of whom 1,179 lay dead on the beaches and along the promenade. Rundstedt radioed at 6:15 p.m. that no armed Englishman was left ashore. The message provoked in Hitler the bare flicker of a smile. Rundstedt noted on the 21st, quote, Schmutz said that he was very grateful and happy about Dieppe. Zietzler, Rundstedt's chief of staff, who was over there yesterday, said it looked crazy, heaps of dead Englishmen, sunken shipping, etc., end quote. Hitler sent his interpreter, Paul Schmidt, to question the prisoners. One prisoner bluntly told him, quote, the men who ordered this raid and those who organized it are criminals and deserve to be shot for mass murder, end quote. Politically, Churchill's Dieppe decision was inept. The Nazis learned that this entire military effort had been mounted merely in an order to destroy Dieppe Harbor and some guns and radar sites. Hitler was nonplussed that Churchill had even dispensed with the paratroops. Had these landed in the rear and fought off the reserves, the day might have ended very differently. In September, secretly addressing his Western commanders, he predicted that the real invasion, the enemy would rely far more on air power. Quote, "We must realize that we are not alone in learning a lesson from Dieppe. The British have also learned. We must reckon with a totally different mode of attack, and at quite a different place." End quote. The Atlantic Wall would now have a vital role. Quote, "If nothing happens in the West next year, we have won the war." And that's the whole chapter.